It's the capacity to be subjectively involved with both individuals, but then importantly, to be able to step back, find a third position, and try and understand what the couple are creating together. Now, although it's kind of obvious in a way, because surely that's what a couple therapist is doing, they're trying to understand the couple relationship, it can have quite a powerful effect on the couple coming for help, because very often they're coming with a different state of mind. They're coming with a state of mind of the other one being felt to be the problem. Quite often, one partner feels brought by the other for treatment. And it's very much a kind of two-person interaction. You know, if you weren't this or you did this for me, then I would be happy. What perhaps the couple don't have is a capacity themselves to step back and observe what they're creating together. And that's the couple state of mind. So the couple state of mind is initially in the therapist. It's the couple therapist's analytic stance, if you like. But what I'm suggesting is that over time, this gets identified with and internalized by the couple into their relationship.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Mary Morgan. Mary Morgan is a psychoanalyst, a couple psychoanalytic psychotherapist, and a writer. She's a fellow of the British Psychoanalytical Society, senior fellow of the Tavistock Relationships, and honorary member of the Polish Society for Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy. We discuss today the concept of a couple state of mind, which is based on a book she wrote, which is called A Couple State of Mind, Psychoanalysis of Couples and the Tavistock Relationships Model. And in this, we unwrap what is a couple state of mind and how it is both similar to and different from an analytic state of mind in the one-to-one relationship, not the couple therapy relationship. And yet there are many overlaps. We take up the issue of countertransference, certainly the issue of projection and projective identification. And we discuss how projective identification can live in a relationship in its defensive format, but also in its creative developmental format. We also consider something that she found important to be in relationships, which is that curiosity is the opposite of narcissism. When one thinks about that, it seems obvious, but one often doesn't think of it quite that way, and we spend some time talking about it. We take up cases which are throughout the book, and we also talk about criteria for termination, which is when she feels that the couple has internalized a couple state of mind. I learned a great deal. I think it applies to work that one does with individuals as well as couples, and there's much to learn. I hope you enjoy, as I did, my conversation with Mary Morgan.
The
welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure. Mary, clinicians who mostly focus on doing individual clinical work are very familiar with the experience where when things go well in a depth treatment, over time, the patient, or perhaps the analysand, begins to identify with what we call the analyzing instrument. That is, they become aware of themselves in a way that they hadn't been before, so that they become curious, they become self-reflective, and they aren't limited to just feeling, saying, or doing things, but they can also become interested about what's happening in me that's leading me to do that. It's one of the gifts of analysis that stays with people long after a termination and is an important part, a key component of our work. Now, you introduce what sounds to me something very similar in your work with couples. And in fact, the title of your book, as I mentioned, is A Couple State of Mind. And we're going to stay with that theme of a couple state of mind throughout the book. And you're going to share with us, which the book is filled with, a number of clinical examples where you feel it is a key point in the mind of the therapist and in the process that happens in the therapy. And I want to read three brief excerpts from your introduction about a couple state of mind, and then I'll ask you to share with us your reflections on it, and then we'll jump into some clinical material. You write, "What might be of most help to the couple is the therapist's capacity to hold a couple state of mind, an important component of which is the capacity to take a third position in relation to the couple. That is, being able to subjectively involved with both individuals, but also at the same time, being able to stand outside the relationship and observe the couple." You go on to say, "Monitoring the internalization of a couple state of mind is diagnostic and helps the therapist think about when the couple could end therapy. But as you later write, it also depends on the state of mind of the therapist." And you write, "One of the triggers for the creative couple developmental process is being with a therapist who expresses a couple state of mind because of her own internal creative couple development." Mary, you want to elaborate on this for us?
Yeah, so when, you know, in a way, a couple state of mind is quite a simple concept. It's the state of mind of a couple analyst who's treating a couple, and you've just described it quite clearly about how it's the capacity to be subjectively involved with both individuals, but then importantly, to be able to step back, find a third position, and try and understand what the couple are creating together. Now, although it's kind of obvious in a way, because surely that's what a couple therapist is doing, they're trying to understand the couple relationship, it can have quite a powerful effect on the couple coming for help, because very often they're coming with a different state of mind. They're coming with a state of mind of the other one being felt to be the problem. Quite often, one partner feels brought by the other for treatment. And it's very much a kind of two-person interaction. You know, if you weren't this or you did this for me, then I would be happy. What perhaps the couple don't have is a capacity themselves to step back and observe what they're creating together. And that's the couple state of mind. So the couple state of mind is initially in the therapist. It's the couple therapist's analytic stance, if you like. But what I'm suggesting is that over time, this gets identified with and internalized by the couple into their relationship. So that, you know, when things break down between them and they have a really difficult row or something like that, blaming each other, at some point, maybe the next day, they can step back and think, well, what was going on there? Why did we get into that kind of familiar place that we can get in together and try and understand really from a kind of third position perspective, what might be going on between them?
That's helpful. Now, do you see that as fundamentally different than the individual analytic state of mind, self-reflective capacity that we're familiar with from individual work?
I think it's a version of that, but in the couple.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, instead of what you were describing of being able to reflect on oneself as an individual, it's about being able to reflect on one's relationship.
I hear you.
It also, just to add here, Harvey, that although I'm talking about this idea in relation to the couple internalizing something as if the treatment progresses well, it also becomes, I'll say to mind, it's a really helpful idea for the therapist. Because, you know, as you can imagine, working with a couple, you can often feel pulled in different directions. You can lose your couple state of mind. You know, you can sympathize with one partner more than the other, this kind of thing. And a couple state of mind can be a sort of anchor for the therapist. It's a place to re-find, you know, when being pulled in different directions by a couple. And it also helps with managing the setting. For example, you know, a couple, usually one partner gets in touch with the therapist, maybe by email, but then the therapist will always ask, can you please copy in your partner? So it's sort of, in that way, it's also quite helpful in thinking and maintaining the setting for a couple.
That's helpful. The best way we can really feel what you're saying is through your clinical examples, which, as I say, the book is filled with. Why don't you start us off with David and Kay as they demonstrate many of the principles that you're describing. The way you introduce them, you say, David and Kay, a couple who struggled with love and hate. Why don't you go from there? It's a provocative introduction.
Okay. So this couple, Kay was 45, David 55, and they'd been married for just 5 years. It was David's second marriage, and he had two young adult children. Kay didn't have any children, and it was her first marriage. So when I first met this couple, Harvey, I was really struck by Kay's hatred, really. She was so angry with David. She felt that she was better off without him. And she became very sort of dysregulated, shouting and saying that she was close to breakdown. David, I could see, was very alarmed. He couldn't understand how things had gone so wrong between them. And he spoke very warmly about Kay and said he loved her. And he tried to reach out to her to comfort her. And she angrily pushed him away. It was quite a kind of shocking moment in that first session. She then told me, when she recovered, she told me that David's two young adult children had moved back into the home soon after they were married. And she just felt their behavior was abominable. She felt they were very dependent, very demanding of their father. And I felt that she was worried that they would destroy him, but also was very envious, I think, of his love for them. So again, she talked in this quite sort of hard way, saying she thought children were like birds in a nest, and at a certain point they had to be pushed out of the nest and they just had to fly. David felt, as a parent, you really had to look after your children, whatever age they were, if they needed your help. So in terms of my countertransference, and this is where couple state of mind was helpful, I did immediately feel much more sympathetic to David. He seemed a very warm, caring man. I felt he'd lost his first wife, and now he was worried about Kay, worried about his children. But I tried to think about why these two people were together and what they were creating together. And although Kay wouldn't let me make much contact with her, we carried on. And eventually, well, after about a few months, I would say maybe 3 months into the therapy, she told me that when she met David, she had allowed herself to become excited for the first time ever in her life. And I asked her, what was it that she felt had so excited her? And she said that she'd found love. And this was said in such a way that for a moment we were all silenced. After a few minutes, she told me something important about her childhood, that she had grown up in care overseas and had no contact with her family. And then one day, I think she was 7, she had a visitor and it was her mother. And she was so excited. to meet her mother, and she persuaded her mother to come back in 2 weeks to see her again. I think the mother was going to bring one of her half-siblings. Anyway, she described how she, you know, could think of nothing else for these 2 weeks. Well, and you can imagine what happened. So the mother didn't turn up. And that was the end of it. She never saw her mother again. So having heard this story, I thought, well, perhaps Kay isn't, it's not that she doesn't have any love. She's just so frightened of love. And I thought that she'd been telling me before about an experience with David, or having found the capacity to love and be loved. It's so important for her. But then I had to think about, well, you know, why was David so drawn to Kay? Because, see, I think that in a way, because David sort of, she said that David, when she met him, she thought he had a kind of excess of love. And I felt that Kay was sort of projecting her kind of fragile experience of love into David for safekeeping. And David told me that he'd started off his life very differently from Kay. He had came from quite an affluent background. But then his father's business had failed and the couple were plunged from wealth into poverty. And his mother never recovered from the shock of that, and their circumstances changed completely. The mother's health failed. And I think that's when David first became a sort of carer, really. Cared for his mother, and now, of course, he was back to Perry for his grown-up children. I came to think that while Kay was frightened of love, David was more frightened of hate and aggression. But it was many more months into the therapy before he could start to express how angry and let down he'd felt by his parents. And I thought that he was scared of his anger. It felt dangerous, as if somehow inside himself he felt that if he got in touch with those feelings, he'd completely sort of kill off his parents, his fragile parents altogether. So, you know, drawing on a couple state of mind, trying to understand what was going on between this couple, I felt that David had been drawn to Kay's robustness, in which she could express negative, even hostile feelings. And maybe he'd thought, maybe not consciously, but bringing Kay into the family was just what his children needed, actually. And I think Kay felt, you know, maybe she could have a family at last. So they were very kind of hopeful signs, I think, at the beginning. But they seem to then have created a projective system, which is it's a couple analytic concept, really, an idea that
we're going to get to it.
Split off and project various aspects.
Let me read how the treatment evolved. You paint a very rich picture of each of them containing a piece of themselves and relying on the other to represent the other part of themselves. And one can't think about a psychoanalytic couple therapy without, of course, considering projection and projective identification. But the way you describe the ending of this treatment, or in the book, you write, at the point of ending the therapy, it seemed that the couple had more of a capacity to relate to the other as an other rather than as a figure saturated and heavy with transference and projections. It was not that they didn't relate to the other in these distorted ways, but some light was getting in now. I love that phrase. Some light was getting in now. Freeing themselves from a very fixed projective system meant being more in contact with the loving and hating aspects of themselves, which caused anxiety in each of them and challenged their relationship. However, the relationship was less constrained now, enabling them to work through with me some of the disappointments about each other and the relationship. Although not easy for them, and I would add probably not easy for anybody, this made room for some new possibilities between them, and I felt some optimism about them. It's a wonderful description, and we're going to get to some of the concepts you mentioned in more detail about the projective system and the countertransference, et cetera. But let me then jump to your chapter 2, which has to do with assessment. Everybody who comes for treatment needs to be assessed to be determined what kind of treatment is the treatment of choice. And you write, the couple often has an agenda, wanting advice or a quick fix to solve the problem. The couple may have little idea of what psychoanalytic couple therapy is and need help in engaging in an analytic process. In their minds, they are coming to an expert, but not really wanting therapy, or at least the kind of therapy being offered. The therapist, by holding a couple state of mind and providing a different kind of space, a couple analytic space, offers the couple as a couple containment, which, while not what they imagined, they do indeed quite often respond to. Now, let me go before the couple shows up in your office, because people make decisions about what kind of treatment they feel they need in all kinds of ways, recommendations, fantasies, TV shows. You know, it's the variety of the human imagination. So some people, I imagine, come to you because you're known as a couple therapist, so they come as a couple. But for those of us who aren't known as either a couple or individual, but can do both, how do we decide, or what's your thinking process about when you see an individual, what leads you to recommend couple therapy? Or when you see a couple, what leads you to recommend individual therapy? Or when you suggest that the other be added on to the current treatment? How does your mind process that part of the assessment?
Well, the last thing you said, Harvey, I wouldn't do. Because I think if an individual is in treatment, I think it's problematic then to invite the partner to join that treatment.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to join the individual treatment.
It's very unbalanced, isn't it?
Yes. I meant to refer them out to another clinician. Yes.
Oh, for individual treatment. If it was a couple, do you mean? And then referring one of them for individual treatment?
Well, either way, if you're seeing a couple, what do you need to see or think to send one to individual treatment? Or if you're seeing an individual, to refer them out to a couple therapist, another person, for couple treatment in addition to the individual treatment?
Well, I mean, maybe I could, it's an interesting question, and maybe I can answer it in quite sort of general terms, because I do get quite a lot of referrals for couples work from individual analysts. And, you know, it may be, and I think this is probably true, that there is a certain area that is difficult to access in individual treatment, and it is to do with the specific sort of link that a couple make, which, you know, you wouldn't have access to as the individual therapist. Of course, you've got your relationship with the patient, and that is another kind of link. So it might be that as an individual analyst, I might feel there's something that I can't kind of get to that's more located in the couple dynamic. For example, maybe there could be kind of progress made after a few sessions, and it all gets undone again once that person is interacting with their partner. So there's something sort of in the relationship that needs to be accessed. And equally, of course, couple therapy, although I do think that in couple therapy, deep analytic work can be done, particularly in long-term treatments. Some couples might come for therapy for 5 years, for example. But there might be, or there will be areas in each of the individuals that are harder to get to in that couple setting, which feel important. And I think that might be a reason for then suggesting they also have some individual work, either at the end of the couple therapy or parallel to the couple therapy. And it can work very well, Harvey, if the couple or the individual can bring those other treatments, you know, what they've understood from those other treatments into the setting that you're in, whether you're with the individual or the couple. I think where it gets difficult sometimes is the individuals are in individual therapy and they don't talk about any of it in the couple of sessions. You know, they say, oh, I've talked about that in my individual session about my past or this, that, and the other, and don't bring it, you know, to the couple sessions. And that's a bit frustrating.
One also faces the challenge where there's something that the patient is struggling with in the transference and they can't quite have it become alive. and it is being acted out in the couple. And you're left with a dilemma. Well, if you suggest that they act it out with the partner, the spouse, maybe that would be useful, but maybe also it's distracting them from the displacement quality of the transference. So it is by no means an easy call.
No. No, that's a good point.
But in either setting, as you point out, countertransference is always present. Let me read what you wrote about that. The couple's anxieties can lodge in the therapist and be difficult to think about. Instead, there can be enactments. For example, the therapist can be pushed into telling the couple what to do, telling them what a couple relationship is, taking sides, reassuring them, and making assurances that she cannot realistically make or fulfill. You go on to say, holding a couple state of mind is not so easy at this early stage. We cannot avoid difficult and unsettling feelings of judgment, liking one partner more than the other, really disliking a couple, feeling useless, dismissed, attacked, bored, or idealized. It is not always easy for the therapist to maintain an evenly balanced view of the couple. The therapist may feel at a loss to understand why these two people are together when one seems quite reasonable and likable and the other so irrational and unlikable. You have a clinical example of that in a moment that we can get to, but you want to tell us something about the kind of countertransferences that, in fact, may be unique to couple therapy because you are meeting the two people. You're not just hearing about one of them.
Yeah. I think you've touched on some of the important ones. It is very different, I think, to individual therapy. A couple can come for help not really thinking that they're coming for therapy, or they don't really necessarily non-therapy. They want the problem to be solved. They're very often in a crisis. Couple is coming for help. Something's happened. Something happens in relation to the children, or there's been unfair, or there's been some violence, something like that. So, although it's an assessment, I think an important part of the assessment is always about containment, trying to contain the current crisis. You know, as you say, couples often want sort of advice, or they want to be told kind of what to do. Obviously, the analytic couple therapist resists that and does something rather different, which is to try and create a different kind of space, really, in which the couple can, you know, think together. Listening is often really difficult for couples and something that the therapist needs to help them to do. So, you know, it's about kind of, it is, I think, in that in that first meeting, it's about containing, it's about creating a different kind of space to the one that the couple are kind of inhabiting outside the therapy, where there's very, you know, there's a lot of attacking each other, feeling, blaming each other, that kind of thing. So
let me read what you wrote where you describe a countertransference reaction. This is an example of Julia and Rob, and you write, I felt this uneven response strongly with a young couple who came to see me. The female partner, Julia, was a professional woman appealing and easy to talk to, while her male partner, Rob, was independently wealthy and presented as a kind of dropout with no apparent personal ambition. Rob was uncommunicative and dismissive of me, making it clear that he felt coming to see someone like me was a waste of time. It was fairly obvious to me that I might be more identified with her, but I still struggled in the first meeting to understand how these two people could be together. I thought about my antipathy and rather judgmental internal response. I felt that if I came into therapy, I would in time understand more about this. This helped me survive a very difficult first session. I did come to understand a projective system in which much of Julia's disturbance behind her capable professional self was projected and contained in Rob. Over time, I saw that Rob possessed great warmth and responsiveness, which I came to witness in relation to both her and me. He was able to let me know from the beginning about this more disturbed, anti-relating part of their relationship, which it emerged was preventing the expression of more loving feelings between them. it's a lovely and concise description of some of the struggles one has, as you say, in the initial encounter of feeling put off by somebody and then opening yourself. And again, this is parallel to individual work as well. You open yourself to, where is this going to go? What's this journey we're about to go on? And being open-minded and curious is a key quality of the therapist. And in fact, in a bit, we're going to read a little piece that you included about curiosity and how important it is. Let me switch us now to what you've written about unconscious beliefs. You write about unconscious beliefs. These are unconscious fantasies that don't shift in response to an external reality that doesn't confirm them. Let me read that again. Unconscious beliefs are unconscious fantasies that don't shift in response to an external reality that doesn't confirm them. They are shutting out of the new so that increasingly one must limit internal and external experience. Those aspects of reality that don't confirm the belief may be ignored or expressed or experienced as a contrary belief threatening the self. And you go on to say, when unconscious beliefs are dominating reality, there is often a particular kind of atmosphere in the session, speaking of countertransference. The emotional tone of a session is often one of certainty, and it feels difficult for the therapist to offer another view and make an interpretation. If the therapist tries to do this, she can be experienced as completely missing the point, not understanding or trying to impose another reality experienced by the couple as her own belief. This presence of unconscious beliefs can evoke disturbing countertransference from feeling annihilated and helpless or aggressive towards the couple, wanting to forcibly stop them. Can you tell us more about what it's like in the presence of these fixed beliefs? It sounds like almost a description of a delusion, and maybe that is what you mean. Well, let me ask, is that what you mean?
Yes, I think that actually Anthony Storr, I think it was, describes this exactly the same thing, but he does use the word a delusion. But I think other writers, Britton in particular, talks about how some unconscious fantasies are deeper in the unconscious and less amenable to change. One can wonder why that occurs. And I imagine part of it is that there's continual and confirmatory experience. So reality keeps confirming the fantasy, and then it becomes a rather fixed belief. There's two things I think are helpful about this concept in terms of working with couples. One is that I think, you know, you can think about an unconscious belief as a sort of backdrop to the relationship. It's always there, but you can't kind of see it. But it's influencing the couple. It's influencing how they relate together. Sometimes, you know, if one can get hold of the unconscious belief, it could be something like it's really couples have to be perfectly attuned to each other, for example. So if you understand that that's a belief that's operating, you can see why the couple gets so distressed when one or the other misunderstands them, for example. So it's a kind of helpful concept in understanding sort of irrational behavior, if you like, between a couple. But the other thing I think that you were picking up, Harvey, is sort of recognizing when you're in the presence of an unconscious belief, and how that can be experienced in the countertransference, and therapists can become very lecturing or repetitive, or, as you pointed out, you know, feeling hopeless, depressed, aggressive, because if she's up against something that feels very immovable.
I just want to put an asterisk next to each time when you say, "I pointed out." It wasn't exactly I who pointed it out. I was reading your words. So we need to have the credit be where it belongs. But you give a wonderful example, and it's a very commonplace example. That's what I enjoyed it so much. that this was about what time the husband came home from work. Now, this was a couple where the husband was working. This is with Jake and Simone. And the wife was not. She was taking care of the children. And they struggled mightily over whether he would come home in time to have dinner with the kids. And do you want to share with us what evolved and what you were able to bring to light, speaking about unconscious shared fantasies? It's a great story.
Yes, I will. Yeah. But just before I talk about it, let me just say that there's a kind of, there's different kinds of unconscious fantasies. The way I think about it, unconscious fantasies are operating all the time in all of us, in couple relationships, but they can get modified by reality. We've just talked about unconscious beliefs. And with this couple, I'm talking about something else in the same area, which is about shared, about kind of assumptions about the relationship. So they are a kind of belief, but they can be very accessible to consciousness, but the couple don't talk about them. And that's the situation with Jake and Simone. So in this session, Jake and Simone were arguing about the fact that Jake was often late coming home to see the children. And he used to get into a state of saying, oh, I'm so sorry, I'll do it better. I'll make sure I'm there tomorrow evening. And so it would go on. But he very often wasn't. And Simone felt very unheard and quite despairing. But I realized listening to them that they were arguing kind of based on the idea that this was how the relationship should be, as if they both had that kind of assumption about the relationship. And when I sort of put that to them, you feel this is how a relationship should be. Jake should be home at 6 o'clock in the evening. Simone was really outraged. She said, but that's what being part of a family is, isn't it? But I kind of pursued the thought. And of course, what emerged was that it actually wasn't possible for Jake to come home at 6 o'clock every evening. His work didn't actually allow that to happen. But because he wanted it, and he joined Simone in thinking that that is what a family should do, he carried on trying to do it, leading to this sort of endlessly frustrating situation between them. So, once we were able to identify this, then they could, talk about their disappointment, that they couldn't manage this, and then try and think a bit more creatively about how they might manage things in a different way between them.
It's such an everyday example that speaks to this unspoken, unconscious fantasy. But let me, a little playfully, Mary, ask you a question. You and I, a bit ago, just had an exchange where you were telling me that what I said was so wise or helpful or intuitive. And what I said, in fact, these were your words. So you and I had a back and forth in a couple spirit, given the topic we're talking about. How would you characterize that using your language? You were projecting a part of your skillfulness onto me, and I was returning it to you. That's how it strikes me.
Yes, I mean, I think we could think about it as our little kind of mini projective system, and it's interesting that couples don't just project negative feelings onto each other. Actually, they could, for some reason, I could be disowning something positive about me and projecting it into you. So maybe that's what happened to me. Or maybe I just like hearing talk about the war.
And I'm going to insist you keep it, just to let you know, right? That's what I think. All right.
Or maybe I just like hearing you talk about my work. That's an interesting idea. Oh, yes, that's me.
Fair enough. Either way, it works. Speaking about talking about your work, there's a chapter on, of course, transference, and you write, relationships, and particularly the intimate adult couple relationship, are one of the arenas in which unresolved aspects of the past, alive in the present, are unconsciously brought and repeated with intensity. Thus, in psychoanalytic couple therapy, we see transference dynamics occurring not only in the couple-therapist relationship, but in the couple relationship itself, a relationship that has a life outside the therapy, but which is brought into and becomes a focus in the couple analytic setting. And then you go on to give an example. And you say, and this I would think is what makes analytic couple therapy unique. I'll ask you to share your thought on that. You write, when a couple is talking about events that have occurred during the week, the therapist is thinking about this not only as a description of something that has occurred and their emotional experience of it, but as an unconscious communication of something in the present relationship in the room, both between the couple now or between her and the couple. Now, that strikes me as uniquely analytic, and couple therapists with different mindsets and orientations, if not capacities, would not be open to considering that dimension of what they're listening to. Does that seem correct to you?
Well, I think it is. It's an area that I think people do struggle with, you know, how to think about the transference and work with the transference in couple therapy. And, you know, what I'm saying is that there is a transference relationship that needs to be understood between the couple. And also, obviously, transference is everywhere, isn't it? So there's transference to the therapist, both from each individual and from the couple as a pair. So it's quite a kind of complicated situation. When I wrote this chapter, I was trying to address how difficult it can feel as a couple therapist to work with the transference from the couple to her or to him. And then I gave an example, which I think we're going to go on to maybe, Eva and John, to just try and think about the different ways in which one could think about the transference.
Let me just read an example of what you wrote about mm-hmm. that. Yes, you write, in one session, Eva and John arrived a little late. Eva was upset that another parent in the school playground seemed to ignore her when she was trying to get to her attention. It left her feeling rather embarrassed. She imagined other parents had noticed. And you comment and reflect on that. You say, there are several ways this material can be thought about and interpreted. For example, this upsetting experience could be a communication about how Eva felt in the session, ignored by me. It could also be, as in a self-representing event, how she actually feels about what is happening in the session. It could be understood as how Eva feels in the relationship with John, at times feeling left on her own with the children, waving to John for some help and feeling ignored. And you go on and give many other examples. I suspect that you're being open to these multiple possible meanings and knowing how to test them out to see which one is most alive and available to the couple is what characterizes analytic couple therapy.
That's right. And, you know, and I would add to that, you know, as well as these different ways of understanding how Eva's feeling, there's also the possibility that Eva is bringing something into the session that has a meaning for both of them. You know, maybe although Eva brings it, you know, as something that happened to her in the playground trying to, I think she's trying to get the attention of the teacher. Maybe there's something in the relationship in which neither of them feel they can get through to each other. They're both kind of waving at each other and feeling ignored. So that's another, you know, something that probably is quite unique to analytic couple therapy, that one partner might bring something. They could even bring a dream or something like that. But what is the meaning, or how do they both associate to that dream, or to, you know, what's being recounted in the way that Eva was? Yeah.
So let's talk directly to the projective system, which is underlining some of the foundational themes that you've been bringing forward. And one of the many things I learned from your book is you make clear that the projective identification that goes on between a couple can have both defensive and developmental aspects. Obviously, this isn't binary, that things are always an admixture. But you write, the couple's projective system is a key couple psychoanalytic concept. It describes a way the couples relate through projective identification, creating a flexible, semi-permanent, or more or less fixed unconscious system. At its center is the concept of projective identification, particularly the way that projective identifications can be seen to function interpersonally and reciprocally through mutual projective identification and counter-projective identification. Now, you go on to describe these different expressions of it, and you have a wonderful case. But before I just we get to that, I want to read this other part that I found very moving. You write, for most couples, their projective system contains defensive and developmental elements. At times, it functions more defensively, and at other times, more developmentally. Its defensive function can support the couple, as, for example, Kudmer and Judd, you quote, found in working with couples who had lost a child. They found that while one partner temporarily carried the pain of the overwhelming loss, the other could function and contain, quote, all the couples we saw who used their relationship to assist them in their mourning demonstrated this flexibility, an ability to take turns in looking after and being looked after. Before we get to your example of this, can you say more about this? I found it very fresh.
So Kudmore and Judd met with many, many couples. They were doing research, and they met with many couples who had lost a child. But I think what they discovered is something really important about the kind of defensive and developmental aspect of a projective system, that even when there are defensive elements, so one partner is temporarily, say, unable to mourn, it works for the couple. You know, that sometimes these defensive elements are important in a couple relationship. It's easy to think that, and sometimes, you know, the couple therapist or a kind of new couple therapist might think we have to sort of deal with this defensive nature of the projective system where the couple are splitting off unwanted parts into the other. We have to kind of get them to take them back. But sometimes it's helpful that a partner temporarily, or maybe even semi-permanently, you know, maybe the relationship works better with some of these defensive elements. You know, I agree, I'll carry that part for you if you'll carry this part for me, because you can manage it better than me and I can manage that better than you. Obviously, I'm talking about something that's going on unconsciously, but it's that kind of dynamic.
And to stay with the creative functioning, you write, while excessive and intrusive projective identification in a couple relationship is clearly destructive of any creativity, there are ways in which projective identification and the couple projective system can help the couple's functioning. Now, you have an example of Olivia and Jack. It's too long to read in detail. Can you give us a summary of that? You say at the end, the defensive nature of their projective system was permeable and open to change. And that's the key part. You want to sort of summarize what they presented with and how it evolved into that creative
system. So I'll try and summarize it. So they were a couple. They were a kind of crossroads in their relationship. They were stuck. They didn't know whether to separate and become just say good friends, or whether they wanted to commit to each other and you know, had to start a family. They were really stuck, and it wasn't clear why. And then a few months into the therapy, they shared with me something that was very, very painful, which was that when they moved to London 2 years previously for work, they left behind Olivia's brother, Al, who was schizophrenic. And they'd both been involved, actually, in caring for him. It's one of the things that bonded this couple, was their care of Al. But tragically, shortly after they moved to London, he committed suicide. But they hadn't talked about this in the therapy. So then there was the next session, and they told me about it in one session. Then they came the following week, and Olivia was feeling very angry about sort of raking over this again. And she said, look, you know, we needed our jobs. We couldn't do, you know, it's not our fault. It's just something that happened. And I noticed that Jack was very quiet at that moment in the session. And I asked him what he was thinking. And he said to Olivia, do you really want to know what I'm thinking? And she said she did. And Jack said he felt they'd done the most terrible thing. And, you know, I still feel moved, actually, just kind of remembering that moment. She then sort of, you know, really felt, well,
yeah, I can feel it too.
Yeah,
sure.
I started sobbing. And then beginning of being able to mourn the loss of Al. But what I understood in terms of their projective system was that that Jack had carried this feeling on behalf of both of them for a couple of years, probably. And it was only at this point in the therapy and in their relationship that Olivia felt able to take back the projection. And the interesting thing is that, you know, once we then obviously did a lot of work on mourning and the loss of Al and what had happened, and it freed up something in the couple relationship. So I think it's an example of, yes, of course, there was a defensive process here of Olivia projecting into Jack and wanting to keep it in Jack. She didn't want to know about it. But Jack was containing something on behalf of both of them. And when Olivia was ready, he could say what he'd never said before and she could hear it and I'll begin to take back the projection.
Marriage as it at its best. We could stay with that, but I want to make sure we have time to talk about what you've written and quoted about curiosity. You quote Coleman, and I'll read the quote you pull in the book. You write, "Curiosity is the opposite of narcissism." I want to repeat that. Curiosity is the opposite of narcissism. Where curiosity seeks to know, intrusiveness seeks to possess, to incorporate the unknown of the other into the boundaries of the self, and so to abrogate the painful rubbing up against the reality of difference. Alternatively, the narcissistic person may claim to already know the other, since what he actually sees and takes for the other is merely the reflection of his own projective identifications. Curiosity is the opposite of narcissism. This, of course, does not only apply in couples. It applies to all of us and in all of life. And you have thoughts about it, and also the presence and meaning of gratitude as part of the opposite of narcissism. Do you want to share your thinking on that?
Yeah, so that's you just given a kind of good description, my description, Harvey, of narcissistic relate.
There you go. Right.
I'm not going to project into you at this moment.
Actually, to be precise, it's Coleman's description. It's Coleman. We have to honor him. He wrote it, but you quoted it.
So, you know, there's been a lot of really interesting work on narcissistic relating, actually, and drawing on concepts of intrusive projective identification and the difficulty in managing separateness and difference. Uh-huh. Well, one of the difficult things about curiosity, I think, in a couple relationship is that, couples are often present for couple therapy in very kind of persecuted states where they feel, you know, under siege from the other, they don't feel heard, they feel misunderstood. So it's quite hard then for them to get into, to be curious about how the other one feels or thinks. When they don't feel that that's available to them from their partner. So that's something specific, I think, about couple therapy. And of course, the therapist's curiosity becomes really important here, so that the therapist can take on that role of trying to open things up. But the other thing I wanted to say about curiosity is that, in the early stages of a relationship, we can call it the in-love stage, there isn't very much curiosity or care, as Bjorn described, because one feels kind of one with the other. You know, the couple bond over what they feel is the same. You know, the idea of having found my other half or whatever. These ideas were around.
Mm-hmm.
And then as that sort of breaks down and there's the possibility of developing, we could call it a more mature love state, one has to sort of start instead of finding the one, it's like finding the other and getting to know the other. And of course, curiosity is very important at that point. But I would say that even those who manage to move from the in-love state to the more kind of mature love, there still can be difficulties in discovering the otherness of the other that's different from the self. You might then discover there's things about the other that don't sit very comfortably with you, or you don't like very much. And this can sort of close down on curiosity. You know, because we can never, what one probably discovers is you can never know another person completely or be known by another person. And that's difficult.
Sure. And as you mentioned, gratitude is an important part of perhaps a foundation of a more mature love, where you may not love every aspect of the person, but you can be grateful for them, even in the face of their imperfections.
Exactly. Yeah.
We need to cover the issue of, we can't have a conversation about couple therapy without talking about sex, since it is part of coupledom and is certainly part of what brings people to treatment. And it's in your section on what is a couple interpretation, you write, the interpretations are made from a third position about the relationship and therefore offers a perspective that is not about who is doing what to whom, but what they are unconsciously creating together. If effective, it should, at least for a moment, bring an alternative state of mind from that of blame and accusation and offer the couple a different way of seeing things. Couple interpretations aim to help the couple find a place, a third position from which they can see what they are creating or recreating between them. And I want to briefly read a clinical example that touches on this and a sexual struggle. You write about Anne and Bill. The wife, Anne, is talking about sex and the way she feels her cues about wanting sex are not responded to by her husband. Bill, in his defense, he cites a few recent occasions where he had made quite a direct sexual advance to his wife and she had ignored it. The wife is dumbfounded and says she cannot remember any of these occasions. There is blame and recrimination, rejection and hurt. The therapist is addressing this and perhaps helping them think about how they might communicate their wish for sex more openly, more directly. However, the complaints are repeated in the next few sessions, and the therapist becomes aware that she is being recruited to mediate. It feels rather fruitless. At some point, she is able to find a third position, her couple's state of mind, in which she can think about what is happening in the relationship. In this case, the couple is unconsciously creating a dynamic in which they can be certain that there will be no sex. This would be the basis of the couple interpretation, and by now the therapist might also have some sense of what anxieties lie behind this no sex defense, which then might also be part of the interpretation or be part of a later interpretation if the couple is able to connect with the idea that this is something they are creating together. I think that's a wonderful and clear example of a common phenomena where the underlying agenda for each of them is hidden in the accusation against the other. Is there anything further you want to elaborate on that?
Well, I think it's also quite a good example, I think, isn't it, of trying to understand, yes, it's about sex. And as you say, Harvey, sex is an important part of couple therapy, but often the couple are kind of caught up in something together which they can't sort of very easily see, and the therapist has to sort of try and understand how can it be this couple both want to have sex, they still want a sexual relationship, but it's something's getting in the way of it happening. And in this case, of course, it was a case of mine. I identify that there are a lot of anxieties about sex for this couple, which meant that between them, unintentionally, they were sort of setting up a defense against it. They were making sure that they never had to have sex. So it is an example of probably what can happen for many couples that's struggling in this area, but also it's an example of a couple state of mind, isn't it, and a couple interpretation. I should say about a couple interpretation briefly that it's not that you know, the way I think about couple interpretations, it's not that we're able to make couple interpretations all the time. I think, you know, with a couple state of mind, it's possible to move flexibly between the different relationships in the room. So sometimes, of course, you're talking to one or other partner, but one is always trying to or leaning towards an understanding of the couple. So from time to time, one gets to a point where it's possible to say something about what the therapist thinks is happening between them unconsciously.
Let's close where we began, which is the theme of the couple state of mind. And it has to do with not only our ending, but the terminating of the treatment. You write at the end of the book, the couple state of mind missing in the couple when they come for help is provided by the couple therapist as a function of the therapist and gradually internalized by the couple over the course of the therapy. And you go on to say, once it is internalized, the therapist may feel that the couple does not need her in the same way and that she can start to imagine an exit from their relationship. This capacity to use a couple state of mind is an indication of development in the couple, as an indication that the couple is progressing towards ending. It may not be for a while, it could be in a year or more, but as long as the couple sustains this, an ending is in sight. Mary, for the many listeners to this conversation who are not themselves involved in couple work, and if they only see individuals, they nevertheless hear about individual partners as a regular part of individual treatment. And everything that you've written about and we've touched upon applies even when seeing an individual, because one often finds oneself caught in, do you know what the couple did or the partner did? And one's a victim and one's a perpetrator. And those states of mind don't require a couple to be in the office, because there are always more people in the office than are in the office. So this work enriches my and our understanding of the internal couple, which includes being the analyst and the analysand, as well as the various partners of each of them. And it is well worth one's while. The book is called A Couple State of Mind, Psychoanalysis of Couples and the Tavistock Relationships Model. Mary, thank you for this. And I am going to ask you to own your skills in writing and in your work, because it is they are considerable.
Oh, thank you so much, Harvey. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.